Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You probably think that you are better now.
Hello, and welcome to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's New Chunky Spicy Soups. Time to get fired up. Make sure you find the Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate, review, subscribe to the program. I'm your host, Wayne Blue. I'm joined by co-host Blake Murphy. We have an exciting episode for you today. T-minus, like, roughly 2-3 hours away from the eclipse happening as well. But we have an interview with Marc Gasol that we were able to record last week that we were able to show you in this second segment. But first, Blake, we haven't been able to say this. Raptors won both games over the weekend. How are you feeling,
man? We have something even more rare than the eclipse. The Raptors...
Oh, come on.
The Raptors not only won two in a row, but for the first time since the middle of November... Or sorry, not the first time, but only the fourth time since the middle of November, had back-to-back games where they played like above-average defense statistically. This one was against a Wizards team that had like Kuzma and a bunch of other guys resting, so maybe you don't pat yourself on the back too much. And they gave up 122. It was just that game was such a chuck fest that the pace ended up through the roof. But no, it was like yesterday, kind of who cares? It's two tanking teams. Like all you need to know about yesterday's game is that the Raptors scored 42 points in the first 10 minutes and then scored 2 points over the next 8 minutes. And despite those extremes, still won the game by 8 points. Like that's the type of game that was. But Friday was really, really nice. Huge release for the losing streak. You could tell that meant a lot to the guys. It was kind of the moment on court of, hey, they got RJ and Emmanuel quickly back, and that's been emotional for the team and the locker room, but you got to kind of live that on the court as well. How are you feeling, man? Friday was nice.
Friday was really nice. I think, because I had given that take on Friday, like, look, it's okay to win a game. We're actually stuck. And by the way, the Raptors are exactly in the same spot, okay? Sixth place in their odds. And I just wasn't expecting them to beat Milwaukee, though. I did pick them to cover because the line was like 15.5 or something like that. But for me, it was just the Bucks game. It was funny because I always thought they were going to compete in that one. And then late game, Dame takes over. And it's like the more veteran team takes over. And maybe that's what the Bucks were expecting. But they just committed so many dumb fouls. Like, I don't remember another games where the Raptors had like, didn't have to execute late game. This must be what it's like to be the Lakers. You just show up, and then they foul you nonstop, and then you just don't even have to make buckets late in the game. Because, like, you had my favorite play from that Bucks game was there was a quickly Kelly pick and roll, and both of them somehow got fouled on the same play. The Bucks, I don't know what they were trying to do. Last second, they switched it. Andre Jackson grabbed Kelly on the screen, so he fouled him there. It was in the bonus. That was two free throws.
That one I understand. Like, you're trying to make a basketball play, but the one that followed was not a basketball
play. And then Bobby Portis also body-checked quickly, who was just getting around the screen. So it's like, you're telling me that this Raptors pick and roll, which wasn't even necessarily generating that much, was already giving them both guys getting fouled? Like, the Bucks were just not serious. Obviously, Dame fouled out in that one as well. And
Bucks wanted a moving screen on that one too. The most controversial moving screen of the weekend, of course.
Oh, for sure.
Certainly the one most people were talking about.
I was going to say, by the way, I'm sure a lot of people watched Raptors Bucks instead of, Iowa versus UConn.
I was writing off of that one and obviously had a second screen up, but the timing worked out nicely of, like, I think I filed midway through the third quarter of UConn Iowa. Mm-hmm. And then yesterday the timing worked out perfectly leading to the Wizards.
Was actually perfect.
That Bucks game, like, this is the Bucks lost again since then, so they've dropped 6 of 7 now, mostly to bad teams. I know Giannis was out for that game, but like, this is a team that even without Giannis should be beating the Raptors this time of year.
For sure.
They look bad.
Oh, they looked the Bucks look terrible, man. I mean, I don't know. Like, they just look so old. I think a lot of their errors just came from guys like being lazy. Mm-hmm. We saw a lot of that. It actually reminded me a lot of the first time the Raptors beat the Bucks, like at the very start of the season. Like, Brook Lopez's minutes got really cut short too. He only played 20 in that one. They went small with like Bobby Portis. Like, that wasn't really helping their case all that much. But I think on the Raptors side, it was like RJ getting to the basket and just like doing an amazing job there. Gary, I gave him the first start. Gary's
been
awesome.
Game.
He had a sensational weekend, realistically. And then quickly has just been excellent. I mean, that game he went 14 of 15 from the foul line. This one he went 12 of 12 from the foul line last night against the Wizards. What are you making of, especially with RJ and Emmanuel coming back to the lineup, what are you making of their games, especially now that they have like one last week to showcase what they got?
Yeah, it's nothing that I'm going to extrapolate from too much. You know, how we're going to evaluate those guys long-term is about how that orbits with Scotty. But I think you see pretty quickly the value of getting two of your best, I mean, your two best ball handlers who are going to be back back and healthy in there. Gary has done a great, great job kind of being the only stabilizing offensive force other than Kelly as a playmaker during all this stretch. But you see immediately how much easier life is for Gary when those guys are dropped back in and he doesn't have to create all the stuff for himself. They can create a little bit for him. That's more or less it. Like, I'm not going to take too much from how they looked against Johnny Davis and Corey Kispert and Jordan Poole, right? Like, as a defensive backcourt. But yeah, the upgrade, and I say this as someone who is fond of Javon Freeman Liberty, for example, and thinks he could be an NBA bench guy, the jump from that to Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett in terms of what your first line of attack is crazy. It's just... like, it's an oversimplification, but you got a couple of NBA starting caliber guys back, and that's how it's felt the last couple games. I don't think they're doing anything different than what we're used to. Mm-hmm. Quickley's nose for the free throw line, I will say, has stuck out a little bit. Some of that was, like, he had the ball in his hands in late-game fouling situations against Milwaukee, but 25 free throw attempts over two games is always going to stand out for a guy who has... since he joined the Raptors, struggled to get into the teeth of the paint a little bit. That was encouraging to me. That was probably the most encouraging individual thing from Quickley and RJ. RJ just looks like he's happy to be back and be an RJ.
Yeah, I mean, I think the appreciation with RJ, and we've seen, what, three games since he came back from, obviously, grieving the death of his brother. But the three games since, he's been able to drive, like, 18 to 20 times per game. And I think it's something that's so impressive for a guy who's able to just constantly touch the paint. Now, I think that we've also seen stretches where RJ's had to run the second unit and be the point guard for that group. And that, I don't think was probably successful. Like, when you talk about the fact that the Raptors got up to a 42-13 start, what happened afterwards was, like, the offense completely died off. And I think, RJ got no help from those guys. Let's be honest. Like, he's trying to run a pick and roll with Jalen McDaniels. It's going nowhere. But, still, I do feel like he could probably improve and just, like, I do think that, like, RJ is playing, like, a really, really good game, and then he's probably overextending himself a little bit, and you're seeing a little bit come off the table for him.
Well, you also see the value where, you know, even with Quickley back, like, this team still longer term needs a backup point guard, right? And when RJ would run those bench units in New York, it was a lot of RJ and Brunson come off together. And then they're in there with the bench unit, or he came off and then came in with Quickley.
Yeah,
as the bench unit. It was one or the other. So he was running the bench units in terms of, like, he had the Julius Randle level usage in those groups, but he usually had Emmanuel Quickley and sometimes Jalen Brunson with him. But here, you know, that's not the same if Bruce Brown is the other point guard on the floor, or Javon or Garrett Temple or whoever. Like, that's not Emmanuel Quickley. That's not Jalen Brunson. So that, to me, that highlights a little bit of that. I also think, you know, if we want to nitpick at it, especially with the turnover side, like, RJ's playmaking is much more advanced in transition than it is in, like, a stationary half court setting, which is fine. Like, he hasn't been given a ton of playmaking duties in his career yet. So that's to be expected. But I really do think it, you know, an RJ plus bench unit, when the bench unit involves a couple guys who were in the G League a couple weeks ago, kind of just highlights that, yeah, even with your guys back, you're going to need more. Like, you need more talent in the door this offseason, even as guys get back. And backup point guard's probably one of the bigger spots.
Yeah, I mean, how would you address that? Like, should we sign somebody? Use one of your picks?
We'll see what happens with the draft lottery and stuff like that. Okay. I'm probably not, in a draft like this, I'm probably not penciling any guard in for, like, hey, day one rotation minutes. Like, I remember even, you know, DeLon gets picked 20th overall. He's an older prospect. He did 2 years on a really competitive Utah team. Mm. And the front office was still like, yeah, we should get Corey Joseph to make sure he can come along. Like, point guard's a tough position to learn. So I would probably think one of the three picks, if they keep all three, would look at a point guard somewhere. And then, yeah, we went over the free agent options. And if they use cap space, there's pretty much backup point guard is the only category that's deep in this free agent class.
Right, right. Well, so I mean,
use the mid-level on it again like you did with Dennis, maybe?
I as long as you don't promise him the starting spot and then tell him he's going to be the leader of the team, I think that would definitely help. I think getting Quickley, getting RJ, getting Kelly back, those three have, like, done the majority of the playmaking for the team in the two games since, and they've all looked really strong together. I love the point about Quickley being able to get into paint. I thought that's what the Raptors did a good job of last night, because last night was a really good example of, okay, you get off to a great start, and then they come back, and then you actually have to play a semi-competitive game. This is why, like, for us, it was such a difficult experience of, like, breaking down 40-point losses where, like, again, like, they were just letting go of the rope. and not competing for extended stretches because it takes away the opportunity to actually play with some pressure, right? Like, it doesn't matter whether or not you win or lose against the Wizards, but you were in a close-ish game. You had to execute. And I thought for the Raptors, like, they did a really good job of setting up quickly to be able to score last night. Clearly, quickly had the hot hand. And you saw the Raptors run a lot of horns action. So it's kind of three-man play, two guys in the corner. This time it was Kelly it was Ochai and Gary. You had RJ, Kelly, and then you had quickly deciding which way to go, left or right. I thought they ran a lot of that. They ran a lot of Spain pick and rolls as well late in the game to get quickly involved and get downhill. And then you saw an elevator doors play, which was very, very fun. So what did you like from Darko's execution of the offense late game?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that horns double stuff that they run high on the floor is helpful. And I like the, hey, one wing, one big in here because you've got so many options if you're Emmanuel quickly, right? If you come off the Kelly side, that's a standard pick and roll where maybe Kelly rolls or short rolls, but Kelly also has a little bit of pick to his game. You can also swing it to Kelly, and then Kelly can kind of re-engage in a dribble. Like if you come off the screen and it's not there, you do that quick pitch to Kelly, get the ball back. You also have, you know, RJ can screen, but usually what that is going to set up is RJ's ready on the second side. And depending on how the defense guards that, maybe Kelly can swing back across, or RJ gets it and he goes into, you know, because RJ's left-handed and he can kind of operate on that side of the floor. Right. He catches it and goes into the dribble handoff with whoever's in the left corner. And you've got a little corner action going. I just think it opens up a lot of what you can do there. You look ahead, Jakob Poeltl could very much be in that Kelly Olynyk spot as well. Then you're looking more for the roll threat than the pop and kind of elbow initiation threat. Scotty could be in either spot on that, where you're probably looking more for the switch mismatch in that case. But Scotty's obviously going to expand his kind of elbow playmaking as we roll this forward. So I like that as kind of a staple for them. They also do, whether it's they run the similar to the horns double, they'll do the like stagger screen at the top in like semi transition, and you have so many options there in terms of screening, or like they do this with their Spain pick and roll, their stack pick and roll as well, the leak option where one of the guys is setting the screen and the other guy kind of flares out, and it's like one of the players is popping while the other is still setting the screen, and that has given them some good looks at three-point shots. That's more with Gary in the screener spot. But yeah, and then the elevator doors play. By the way, at the break, I'll show you. They sent me. This is the nice thing about Sportsnet. So we watched that play. It was 5 minutes left, 5-6 minutes left in the fourth quarter. RJ's inbounding right in the corner. And all you can really see on the broadcast is that quickly gets a three off of it. Yeah. And we were like slowing it down earlier and like trying to see where quickly's coming off. And it's like, okay, he is coming between Ochai and Kelly. But the nice thing about working at Sportsnet is I just emailed Gavin Berry and Mike DeAngelis, who are our producers on the TV side. And I was like, hey, do we have any more views of this so we can see the whole action unfold? So yes. I've got those for you at the break. We can't air them on air.
It's good because first off, shouts to Gavin, okay? Media Game MVP.
Yeah, that's right.
I literally messaged him back saying you're the real MVP after he showed us a clip. Yeah, I had actually just like tweeted out the extended clip of this one, but it's a really, really good action. And it was interesting because the Raptors had called, they actually got the ball into the paint already on like the play before Darko called timeout. So I believe Gary got a paint touch catching a high low. Now the defender was all over him and stuff. But you know, he was in a good spot. I think Gary was probably going to take an opportunity to try to score there. Darko called timeout, even though the Raptors had the ball in the paint. It wasn't like they dribble it past half and they call time. They were already mid-play. They called time. And then they came out of it with this play in particular. And my question to you is this perhaps Jama influenced?
It might be. So Jama was with Golden State for a couple of years, and that's the team that runs the most elevator door stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And
doesn't Jama do some, like, after timeout plays and stuff like that too. Yeah. I'm sure like they circle around and everyone gets a chance.
Similar to how he, outsourced delegated in the media game where I had to draw the ATOs.
Y'all were running elevator doors?
Yeah, no, we did try some stack stuff, but so I think that makes sense, right? And even if it's not a play directly out of the Warriors playbook, even if it was, like teams do that stuff all the time. But it's more the like you were in an environment where you had one and really two like really high gravity shooting guys, and Emmanuel quickly and Gary Trent Jr. are not Steph Curry and Klay Thompson,
no,
but against a bad defense. And when those are the two guys who the opposing defense is most geared up to stop anyway, like how the defensive priorities flow is going to be similar, even if those guys, like, no, Quickley's not getting picked up on an elevator doors if it's 35 feet from the net in the way that Steph Curry might.
Yeah.
But how running Steph Curry and then Klay Thompson off the same stagger screen and then have Quickley come through the elevator, like that kind of principle and how a defense reacts to two guys that have some shooting gravity, those principles you can borrow from any situation, even if the players are at a different level. So I like that creativity. Looking forward to asking them about it tomorrow. May I don't know if anyone will talk on record about that. We haven't really, the season has been so down bad, mm-hmm, that like there hasn't even really been an opportunity to ask much X's and O's stuff, because like it hasn't felt like,
yeah,
like when you're losing by 48 points, like the play design doesn't feel like it matters at all, right?
Yeah.
Even though like everything matters. So it'd be nice to like actually get to ask about that stuff for a couple games here, or one game. There's one home game left.
There is just one tomorrow. So yeah, I mean, it'll be a good chance to ask about that, because like, you know, I already mentioned it, when I went to the open practice, like they did like a substantial amount of the time just working on rebounding and like simple drills. They also worked on plays too. Don't get me wrong, but like I was like, wow, like they really had to start here. And for the groups at that time, they really did need to. But when you get some of these guys back, and that's the thing, I'm really looking forward to this group being able to like get more practices and like building off of each other, right? There's only so much work you can do. Like, for example, Grady's been kind of like the one player that's been available, and unfortunately picked up a groin injury, so we'll see if he's available. But like there's only so much you can do when you're that one guy and the rest of the team is there and they don't really even know what to do. Like there was moments yesterday, and I feel bad for Malik Williams because he's here on the 10-day, but like he was like screening his own teammates at some point, you know what I mean? Like, so it's like there's only so much you can do, versus where it's like you now can, like, for example, the horns action they're running, that's a three-man game with three guys that really know how to play, and they've actually played a lot off each other since the, you know, the trade deadline and stuff. So that's the type of meaningful basketball that I think that could actually extend into next season, where, again, hopefully it's not a repeat where the Raptors are, what, 25 and 53?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's a repeat, might lose my mind. But, yeah, no, I think things will be better. And, like, yeah, again, look, this isn't to be negative about Javon and Malik Williams and guys. And the 905 have a system. We talked to Eric Corey about it last week, and they were trying to run some of the same stuff. But there are some things you can do, and that it's worth trying to do more once you get your NBA caliber guys back in the mix. Like, not that they weren't running plays for those other guys, but given a lineup that had Javon and Garrett Temple and Jalen McDaniels on it, they were just like, you know what, we're going to run everything through Kelly Olynyk in the high post and look for cutters, because that's the only thing we're probably going to be able to produce. Mm-hmm. Now we're at least learning stuff. And this was part of my issue with the long losing streak and everyone being out, is like, we're not learning anything.
No,
we're
exactly
finding out about these guys or about how they mesh or what might matter next year. Now at least we've got a couple game window here where there is stuff that matters. Mm-hmm. Quickley's progression, RJ's progression, how those two fit with Gary. You know, what does Kelly look like without the ball in his hands all the time, but actual like better shooters to kick it out to and stuff like that. The stuff that we've seen, even though the outcomes don't really matter, mm-hmm, this is at least stuff where we're learning, and especially for the coaching staff, they're learning stuff that they can then take into, you know, their summer development plan and kind of as they diagram what next year could look like. It's Scotty missing is still like a big kind of,
oh, for sure,
fly in the ointment with doing all this stuff, but they're also going to be like, you're going to play 10 minutes a game next year with Scotty on the bench anyway. Mm. So maybe this is stuff that materializes in non-Scotty minutes and stuff next year too.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's always a development of other guys that I think is going to be quite important here. We got like 2 minutes to talk about Gary just real quickly. I thought he was really disruptive last night, 5 deflections last night. To lead all Raptors. The Raptors had 11 deflections. They had 5. That's pretty good. Kelly had 4. I think for Gary, it's been interesting watching the last couple of games, because we've seen Gary like play different roles, right? We've seen for a while he was kind of a Pascal merchant. Like, Pascal was really good on kickouts and the kickout to Gary. The Raptors also played like an entirely different offense under Nick as they do under Darko. And I think there was an adjustment period for Gary. I think we've seen him struggle sometimes coming off the bench or starting. And, you know, we've had that conversation before as well. I feel like in the last like month-ish or so, he's really settled into like he's back in the starting group now after all the trades and the trade deadline. And I've really just enjoyed what I've seen from Gary. Like, what's your assessment of Gary right now?
Yeah, I've come out of this season higher on Gary than I entered this season, and that feels weird to say given how rough the start was, where he wasn't playing well at all. He had an extended shooting slump. When he got to start, it didn't look all that good, even if he shot a better percentage. And again, he shoots as good a percentage off the bench as he does as a starter. We don't need to do that. But yeah, him, I mean, first of all, kind of being the steady vet hand in a situation where, you know, he's an expiring contract and like he's been through different situations before. Like, he didn't have to be kind of the steady vet guy through all this. He could have got his and, you know, disengaged defensively, put up bad shots. He hasn't really done that. His defense the last little while has been, you know, probably not that 2021, 2022 season level, but certainly it was this weekend. Like, I shouted him out in the piece I wrote Friday as well. It was one of his best defensive games of the season. I thought the same yesterday. Yeah, I think he just deserves a ton of credit because this season hasn't been easy for anyone. Mm-hmm. And other than Grady, he's been the only guy who's been there through every little path of it. And he has trended pretty consistently upward through messy situations. And sometimes it's like, okay, you know, there's a big difference, I guess, between being Jordan Poole and getting 29 points in the situation the Wizards are in right now, mm-hmm. and being Gary Trent and getting 31 points on Friday the way he got them, or 20 points and a couple of steals on Sunday the way he got them. Even if, you know, the core skill set is the same and the competitive situation is the same, there are different ways to go about getting yours in a bad competitive environment. I've been really impressed with how Gary's handled his business for the Raptors this last, I mean, all season really, but especially the last couple months as things went off kind of the rails for the team.
And I think this is something that's not been said, but he is adapting and he is like fitting into the system better and better. I feel like last night he only made 2 threes, but he still had 20 points.
Yeah. Right?
He made 7 twos, which is not something that Gary would do. And then also like 5 assists and 7 rebounds as well. Like, it's just do it consistently, be disruptive consistently. And I think that we've all seen that there's the pathway to being a productive player, you know, or even not more productive, but just like more, not less one dimensional,
higher floor.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like the nights that your 3-point
feast or famine,
the nights your 3-point shot isn't there, what are you still providing? And honestly, that's the difference between a really good 3-point shooter getting the mid-level in free agency this summer and a really good 3-point shooter getting the type of contract Gary was betting he's going to get when he opted in last summer, rather. And who knows, maybe teams aren't reacting to this month of play or whatever, but I've certainly come away from it, you know, more impressed with Gary, the overall player, than I was, you know, certainly in early mid-December.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. We are really excited to show you this Marc Gasol interview. So we're going to take this break. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Wim Liu. I had the great pleasure to talk to Marc Gasol last Friday, and we've been teasing the interview all weekend. Here it is. Joining us on the Raptors show is Marc Gasol. This is such a great pleasure, Mark, because obviously you are a member of the 2019 championship team, and we will talk about that in a bit. But right now the focus is on Memphis. Your jersey is going to be retired. Take me through your emotions. I know Memphis is such an important place to you. You grew up there. You went overseas. You came back there. You brought a lot of winning and pride to the franchise. How does it feel that your number 33 is going up into the rafters?
I feel like a lot of different people are going to go up with that number, and because so many people were a part of my journey and helped me along the way. Pau obviously played in Memphis before me. My parents lived here for so long, and we came here 2001. So a little part of everybody goes up with that number, and so many coworkers, so many friends that we made, you know, are so excited. So I am. So am I too. So, you know, it's a unique journey that I had here. So just thrilled about it. Can't wait.
Yeah, well, it's well-deserved. I mean, you're the career leader in Memphis in minutes, in field goals, in rebounds, in blocks. I think Mike Conley got you in points and assists. But I think you may be number two, or you're quite up there as well. Talk to me about when you first went to Memphis, what you remember about the culture shock of growing up there, because obviously your brother Powell had been in with the Grizzlies before that.
What was your first impression of growing up in Memphis and adapting to the culture?
I can tell you that we were not familiar with the culture at all, and what a shock we had as a family. We all came together. My little brother was 7 at the time. Pa was, you know, I think 21. I was 16. So my parents just left everything behind in Spain and decided that it was a good idea to move here. So we, you know, could give Pa a good support system through his first years of his NBA career. And basketball helped me along the way. Basketball was such an important tool for me to interact, to adapt to a different city. And my teammates from high school helped me along the way, showed me the ropes of how the city worked. So I'm forever thankful for them, for how they treated me and how much patience they had during those years. And yeah, it was definitely different than Barcelona.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, but I think you made yourself at home. You know, you're, I don't know what the name is for people who are from Memphis, but you are Memphis through and through.
Memphis, it's called Memphis.
Yeah.
So much happened during those years. And the love and the respect that Memphis showed to me and my family, we will forever be in debt with them, because it's not easy to take in a family that you know doesn't know much, that is fairly first taking their first steps in a city like this, and the franchise helped us also. So it's just a full circle. We are very thankful and excited for tomorrow.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a really good celebration of the whole era, right? I know there's other that have already been honored like this, but the Grit and Grind Grizzlies, it's something that everyone remembers. Even though you guys didn't reach your ultimate goal of winning the championship together, which I'm sure you guys would have loved to do, but everyone remembers for you guys how hard you guys played defensively. You, Zebo, Mike Conley, Tony Allen, other guys that have come through in that stretch as well. How did you guys get to that point where you found that identity? Like, we're going to win with defense and we're going to just like grind teams down with defense.
I think it started with the coaching staff. Led by Lionel Hollins and his coaching staff, they had a very clear view of how we wanted to play and how we were going to be able to win games. And then, you know, it came to our responsibility of doing what we're supposed to do and making each other better. We bonded right away in the first training camp that we had together, and it just went on from that. And then we're just adding pieces, trying to complement each other. Which wasn't easy because our game was a little bit different, but you know it was awesome. It was awesome beyond wins and losses, because how much it meant to the city and how much of an impact we all had. And I think in a way, all our differences between each other mimic a little bit, you know, with the city also, how different it could be at times, and how we all came together for a common goal. So it was just really good timing. We started to win. And the city, you know, rallied behind us, and you see now, you know, what the franchise has turned out to be, how, you know, the culture now it's so steady and it's growing and it's getting better each season, and hopefully, you know, they can get it together and be healthy and be a great team.
Is there a year that you look back and you're like, this was our best year, like we were the strongest, we had our best chance? What year was that for you guys?
I can't tell you what the best year was, because some, you know, things happen every year, but I think the turning point of everything was our first win in the playoffs against San Antonio, when we were the eighth seed and we, you know, knocked them off. I think that was a moment that created a lot of belief in our city and in our franchise. From that point on, if you know, back then, if you could beat the Spurs four games, you know, you could beat anybody. So that's what we believed in, and that's how we approached every single game. We could never get over the hump. You know, they made us pay back later on in a conference finals. They swept us. But that's just how basketball and life goes sometimes.
Yeah, the Western Conference at that time was just so tough. That's the thing, too. I mean, it was not easy for anybody to get wins over anybody. So I remember this because when the Raptors were making their run and you guys were making the run here in Toronto, there would always be reporters on the road from Memphis wanting to catch up, you know, and it felt like even though you guys couldn't get over the top together in Memphis, so many people were still rooting for you once you came to Toronto. I'm curious on your side, when did you know that Toronto was going to be a potential outcome for you in terms of where you would go? And also, more importantly, like, when did it become known to you that it might not be your whole career in Memphis and that you might have to move on?
Starting from the end of your question, on that year, beginning of the year, you know, we thankfully, Memphis was always very honest with me and Mike. So once they started to go in a different direction, they told us, they let us know that, you know, by All-Star break, you know, we're looking to trade you, mm-hmm. you guys. And you know, they were very honest, and I'm very appreciative of that. And then Toronto was an option, was not always on the table. I think it went back and forth. And then at the last few hours of the trade deadline, became a reality, because at that point, you know, there was a chance that I wasn't going to be traded deadline. I was going to be traded during the draft night. But the last few hours, I think Masai obviously stepped up to the table and they come to an agreement. And the rest is history.
The rest was very, very good history for everybody involved, yeah. I think. I think the other team at that time, if I don't remember correctly, was Charlotte. They might have also been interested.
Something happened with Charlotte at the end that it was not on the table. At least that's what was transmitted to me. So they told me, hey, Mark, you know, get your head around that you might stay in Memphis the rest of the year. So I'm great. Like, I never wanted to leave in the first place anyways. So, but, you know, thankfully, things happened in Toronto, and Masai changed his mind, or I don't know what exactly went down. But, you know, even though part of me was sad that it was over in Memphis, you know, I was ready for the challenge in Toronto and understood the opportunity that we had in mm-hmm. that group, and we went for it.
Yeah, well, I'm curious because your transition to Toronto at that moment, I remember being in New York City. You guys were playing the Knicks. That's when you made your debut. You were coming off the bench, and I don't even know if you had practiced with the team, if you knew anybody on the team. I'm sure you knew Sergio Scariolo, the Raptors assistant coach, right? Obviously, a coach to you with Team Spain. But besides that, I don't know how much you even knew, but instantly you got everybody involved. You and Norman Powell had an instant chemistry right away. And we just knew right away that, you know what, the Raptors were already really good that season. But once we added you, there was a chance that we could win the championship. Is that the feeling that you got when you talk about, you see the opportunity?
Yeah. Obviously, when you look at that roster, and I didn't know how good Norm was going to be. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how good Freddie was going to be and important to the team success. But you look at Kyle, you look at Kawhi, you look at Danny Green, Pascal, you know, Serge Ibaka, and then you see Freddie and Norm, and you're like, and led by Nick Nurse and his staff, I'm like, hey, we have, you know, a really good team. OG wasn't healthy, really, and like, he was in and out a couple times, but, you know, it's such a great combination of veterans with young players, with a player like Kawhi. It's just, you know, you have an opportunity, you got to go and go for it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because for a while it was like, wasn't clear if it was going to be you starting or Serge Ibaka starting. How did you guys work that out? Because I know Serge is a very proud guy as well. I'm sure he wanted to start too, but, you know.
I think we made the most out of it. Yeah. I think Nick, you know, made the decision of who plays better with who and what we need at times. Sometimes Serge finished the game, sometimes I finished mm-hmm. the games. It's at the end of the day, it's what's best for the team and the ultimate goal of winning. So that's all that really matters.
Yeah. Well, that team was so good, but I think game one of the playoffs was so funny against Orlando. I think everyone knew that, you know, the Raptors had a great chance of beating Orlando. I mean, just even the teams on paper. But then game one comes around and there's that three by DJ Augustine. And it's so funny because it's you and Kawhi involved in that pick and roll. And you guys have both won Defensive Player of the Year. And somehow you guys miscommunicated. DJ Augustine got open for three. What was the reaction like in the locker room that day and even the practice afterwards of getting you guys focused after losing that first game?
Win or losses, like, you have to like refocus and cannot, you know, change too much the way you view the games. It was a mistake. You learn from it, you move on. Then, you know, I think from that point on, there was no more miscommunication, and we were not that long together. And you have to go sometimes through moments like that to come closer. But, you know, it happened. It happened. It's basketball. You know, you take ownership, accountability. Mm-hmm. That's what it went in the locker room. Hey, you know, I thought you were going to go over the screen. It wasn't, you know, good screen. He went a little bit under and got stuck. I didn't see. I see a gap that he could went over. You know, we didn't play that many games together, or at least games that were super close together. So I thought it was good that things like that happened that way. The rest of the way, you have, you know, you have more of an understanding of what is expected in certain situations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a weird game. Kyle Lowry scored 0 points. It was just a lot of strangeness that went in. But obviously, you guys went on to win the next four against Orlando. Then you guys play Philadelphia. Game one, you guys looked great. It looked like you guys were going to just keep cruising, but Philly turned out to be, like, the toughest opponent in that entire championship run. I don't know if you agree with that, but they did take you to seven games. Yeah.
Yeah, you look at that roster and the size they had in every position, you know, it was not easy to play and the way we wanted to play. So, you know, it's every series is different and every matchup changes. Mm-hmm. So I think Philly, you know, what they brought to the table against the our strengths, it wasn't easy, but you don't expect anything easy in the playoff anyway. So it was great. I thought that we did a good job adjusting. Nick pushed the buttons that he needed to push for us to be better, and we grew with the series too, because again, like, we were not together for long. At least I wasn't there for long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we needed to learn and trust each other in certain situations that we didn't always know that we were going to be in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of those big adjustments was, going back to earlier, you and Serge playing together, because that's how big the Sixers were. You guys needed to match that size. But I also think one of the big points of that, everyone remembers the Kawhi shot, and I'll ask you about that in a second, but your defense against Joel Embiid, I think for Raptor fans, like, anyone who sees you should say thank you to how you guarded Joel in that series. I mean, Joel Embiid is obviously a phenomenal player, MVP right now, but you held him to 17 points per game in that series on 37% shooting, and you always guarded Joel really well, because the next year you actually held him to zero. And of course, you're going to say it's a team effort, but most importantly, I think it's the person in front of him being able to match up. What were some of the keys that made it successful for you to play against Joel at that time?
Well, they allowed me to be physical with them and not get to his spots easily, and I was, you know, really willing to battle him for every inch that, you know, on the court, and that's what we did. Every make every possession really hard, study his game as much as possible, you know, kind of go at him. Also, when I get a chance offensively and make him work, and don't let him just stand there, and clock the paint like he, you know, he normally will want to. So that's why my 3-point shooting would help at times with spacing wise, and that was it. Just trying to stay very consistent mentally. I think the couple times that he had in the flow, you know, he could go in a tear and score like 15 points in a row. So you didn't want to make anything comfortable for Joel at any point.
Yeah, well, trust me, we still talk about it here in Toronto. Like, nobody has guarded Joel that well, because the Raptors played the Sixers later on, a couple years later after you had left, and he gave the Raptors a lot of problems, and we were all saying, can we sign Marc Gasol to come back for this series? No, but, you know, after that Kawhi shot happened, and I'm sure, you know, I don't know what your perspective was. I think you were the inbounder on that play in Game 7, right? You inbounded to Kawhi, then Kawhi dribbled the whole length of the court, went to the other side, shot the ball. I mean, it was a brick, really, but somehow that was...
That's like we drew it up.
Yeah.
He was determined to take that shot.
Yeah.
It was going to be right. It was going to be going, you know, he's just trying to find the launching spot, and it happened to be really far away from where he started. He made it. You know, we were ready to go to overtime.
Right.
If needed be, obviously. But, you know, he was determined to take in that shot, and he knew what type of shot he wanted to take. And we got a couple lucky bounces.
I think the reaction of – everyone saw Kawhi's reaction going into the crowd. I think your reaction, you like, did a prayer. You gave yourself a little cross. You're like, God spawned us today.
Hey, you know, sometimes it's sports, and the little difference you know, the little things make a huge difference, and we had like I said, a couple lucky bounces on the rim that I don't think I ever seen like that, and I played a lot of ball, but hey, you know, I'll definitely take it, but you know, the difference was like that, it was that small, the difference in those two teams, and it could have went either way. We were just on the lucky side this time.
Mm-hmm. And I thought the other thing, too, what was really sweet was, obviously, this was a difficult moment for Joel Embiid, right? You know, losing in that fashion, you can understand how painful it is. You went over there and you consoled him. Embiid was in tears. You went over there and you hugged him. I don't know what you said to him in that moment, but what do you remember about that specifically?
It's just the respect. You go seven games against somebody, you're not going to be, in love with the person that you're going against. And you match the subs and you're trying to do what's best for your team to win. But nothing but respect. And I told him that his time was coming. Obviously, he became an MVP a few years later. But this just didn't happen to be his time, at least not yet. So I told him the same thing back in, New Orleans when I saw him. First time, he thought he should have made the All-Star. I told him the same thing. Don't worry, your time is coming. Now he's a perennial All-Star. So, as players, we don't have often patience or perspective of how life is. But you could tell that, and you can tell, obviously, that he's, a very special player.
Yeah, well, I mean, the remainder of the playoffs, I mean, I know the next series for Giannis, after you guys were able to go down 0-2, I just remember, to be honest, I thought you could have played better in the first two games. And I think probably for the rest of the team as well, you guys were down 0-2. And, of course, you guys did play better. You guys won the next four straight. Was there something for you in that series when you were down 0-2 against Milwaukee, it clicked for you, like, I could take this game to another level and we can do better as a team, for yourself personally especially?
Yeah. Like I said, like every series you were learning more and more things about, how to help the team and how the team could help you. And so it was a lot of things that you learn on the fly. And yeah, the first game I thought it was hard because we thought that we had it, and at the end we kind of collapsed at the end of the game. But it's how you approach the next one. Mm-hmm. The next one wasn't good for us, and you have to take accountability and be honest with yourself. You cannot try to blame somebody else when your game doesn't go your way. We went back to Toronto, and it wasn't an easy game three. We didn't cruise. It was hard. Was mentally, a hard game to play because you lose that game, it's going to be a wrap. But again, we stayed in the moment. Mm-hmm. We kept making plays. We keep making play after play. And I think somebody fouled out, right, on game three.
I think Kyle might have fouled out. It's because Fred put Kyle a lot of in.
We were lucky and played a good game and made a couple shots. And then we got a confidence back. And then you win game four and you're back to 2-2.
Yeah.
So it's just the game goes. You got to stay in the moment. You can get, too high or too low. You got to stay in it and keep learning and being honest with, yourself and the team. But we spend so little time together that, it's the time that you have to learn. It happens to be during the playoffs.
Yeah, that's what I'm taking away from this, is just how everything had to come together on the fly. It's not like in Memphis where you guys are able to develop the identity, grow, take your time and, really adapt, even adapt your games towards each other. This is like you joined the team midseason, Kawhi joined the team at the start of the season with Danny. The Raptors already had an existing group of guys, and all of it having to click at once, playoff series by playoff series, you guys got stronger. And that's how it looked. I mean, the game six, I mean, the 26-3 comeback, In the third quarter, fourth quarter, that stretch. And that was just so beautiful to see. And, of course, you guys finally make it to the finals. At that point against the Warriors, KD, it wasn't sure if he was going to play or not. What was your confidence level as a team looking at the Warriors who had, at that point, been what? They've won it three times by that point. Kevin Durant was probably going to come back. What was the confidence like in the Toronto locker room going into the finals?
Obviously, every series is different, and you have to just stay in the challenge that you have in front of you. Steph, you have to try to minimize his impact in the game, but he impacts the game no matter what he does. If he's on the ball, off the ball, if he's dribbling, whatever he does, he's impacting the game. Even his misses impact the game. So you have to, control him. Clay was shooting the lights out, and he was, very dangerous. You cannot give him any space. Just their pace was hard to guard with and without the ball. So you have to be able to go back at them and keep up with that scoring at some point. So, we kind of have to see what kind of strength we could use against them. And I thought we did a good job of coming to game one and establishing ourselves. And we're able to win game one that, you know, happened to be, you know, a first game in the finals. They obviously they have been there way more times than us, but we were ready. And that's a testament to everybody on the team. And from that, it was just, you know, you win one, you lose one, you win one, you lose one. And fortunately, we won game six on the road. We were a good team on the road.
I think, yeah, you guys won all the games in Golden State that year. That was the big key. And I think, to your point, the team got stronger. Pascal had his moments. Fred obviously had his moments. Kyle had his moments. You had your moments. Serge had his moments. And it wasn't just like in the Sixers series where Kawhi did all the scoring and, you know, it was more difficult. It was the whole team showing up at once, and it was the beautiful finale to that season. I think one of the things the Raptor fans always love, too, is you at the parade. I don't know. This is a legend at this point, you at the parade. But just walk us through, because the parade was not supposed to be 4 hours. That's what people don't understand.
No. It was not supposed to be 4 hours. But, you know, the amount of energy and people that were out there, and you wanted to thank for their support, because once we won the Eastern Conference Finals, you know, everybody was very excited, and obviously it was something already important, but we wanted to stay in the moment. So to be locked in for that long, it just happened all at once, and I try to cheer and have a beer with the 3.5 million people. It just it was fun. I had a great time. I'm ready for another one.
Yeah, honestly, it was when did you decide, take me through your decision making when you decided to drink the whole bottle of wine? And how close were you to falling off that bus? Because I feel like Eric Moreland, like, saved your life.
No. I was not even halfway there.
Oh, okay. All right. Damn.
No. It just happened to be so long. And I wish we could have a camera up there so you could see the interactions that we have with people and their faces and how excited people were from our point of view. And you know, just wanted to give everyone their moment, and they gave me the bottle, and they're like, and I don't know how many people down there are. You, I'm like, oh, and it happened.
Yeah. All right. Two more questions because we're running out of time. I realized that you never gave a speech when everyone else gave a speech at the end. I don't think you got a speech. Were you too drunk for the speech? Is my question.
Yeah, they told me that Danny Green sabotaged that idea. I don't know why. I didn't really understand why I was fine.
Yeah, I hope you were fine. But, that was the coolest thing was later on that same summer, you go back to represent Spain. You always played for Spain whenever you were available. And you guys go to Eurobasket. That year, I mean, look, Spain is always a favorite, especially in Europe. But that year, the expectations weren't as high. And you guys ultimately were able to come through, win the championship. You got two parades that year. So walk me through the second parade.
Yeah, well, that was a World Cup.
Sorry. Yes.
So, and also with Sergio's, which is like, I just spent, the last maybe 12 weeks with Sergio, pretty much on a submarine, just locked in the rabbit hole and just grinding it out and thinking about, you know, how would you get better. So the parade, the second one, I was just tired. Like, I didn't, you know, obviously people were excited because they saw the parade in Toronto.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be the same. I think we had great times and it was emotional. But after the World Cup in China, I was really, my body, like, you know, I felt it. I felt that one because it just so locked in for so long. It wasn't easy, you know, mentally and physically to withstand. But, you know, we had a great time. We celebrated with, you know, our countrymen. Everybody came out. Pau came out, flew out, you know, from Barcelona. He came to Madrid to celebrate with us. But I was toasted.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, you're beloved in Spain. You're beloved in Memphis. And your jersey's going up in Memphis. Congratulations on that. I don't know if your jersey will go up in Toronto, but at the same time, we would love to have you anytime. You're going to get an incredible ovation every time you come back to Toronto. I think people are going to ask you to chug wine every time you come back too, you know. But still, you are beloved everywhere. Marc Gasol, thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations once again on everything you've done in your career.
Thank you so much, guys. I hope to see you soon.
Okay.
There you go. Marc Gasol, honestly, one of the nicest people to interview. My bad. I really wanted to ask him if I had one more question. I wanted to ask him and Kawhi had the little head nod, and they would just somehow always get a backdoor cut for a dunk. with Mark passing it to him. But still, congratulations to Mark. His jersey got retired. It was in front of Joel Embiid. It was in front of, more importantly, Nick Nurse and Kyle Lowry. And it's always great to go through those memories. I will talk about that championship for the rest of my life. And people are just going to have to deal with that. So that does it for us today. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup. Time to get fired up. Make sure you find The Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please rate and review, subscribe to the program. Thanks to our producer, Amit Mon, our producer, Lance Kennedy. Actually, big thanks to Daniele Franceschi for setting up the Marc Gasol interview in the first place. Jennifer Olick, David Sis, Jared Manetta helping behind the scenes. Big thanks to Marc Gasol, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.